This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
So, my name is Yana Negru, and Dr. Mark Hayes has asked me to step in to chair the session at last minute because of a family illness. So I would like to introduce our two speakers tonight, Dr. Yanis Dafermos, who will present his paper on the design of fiscal rules from the perspective of Wayne Godley and Hyman Minsky, and Dr. Marco Veronese Passarella, who has kindly agreed to respond. Yanis will speak for about 40, 45 minutes, and then Marco for about 20, 25 minutes, leaving maybe half an hour to discuss. Yanis Dafermos is a lecturer in economics at the University of Western England, Bristol Business School. He holds a PhD from University of Athens. He researches and publishes on macroeconomic policy with particular reference to finance and income distribution. And we are very grateful that he has found time to travel from Bristol to speak for the seminar. Marco Veronese Passarella is a research fellow at the University of Leeds, Leeds Business School. He holds a PhD from University of Florence. He researches and publishes on macroeconomics and the history and philosophy of economic thought, and he's very familiar with the perspectives of Godley and Minsky. Mark has kindly agreed to respond to Yanis' paper and lead our discussion. And again, we owe him many thanks for traveling down from Leeds for the day to do this. So Yanis, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. The paper that I'm going to present develops a simple model that attempts to combine certain aspects of Godley and Minsky's macroeconomic analysis. Wayne Godley and Hyman Minsky were two macroeconomists that saw the crisis coming. In 1999, Wayne Godley published his well-known article on the seven unsustainable processes in the United States. One of the main arguments in this article was that the rising private indebtedness in the United States was an unsustainable process, and therefore, he argued that the private expenditures could not be regarded as a source of stable growth in the medium run. In this article, Godley also emphasized the unsustainability of the increasing net foreign indebtedness in the United States. Using these arguments and a stock flow consistent framework, Godley produced some projections according to which the United States would have a crisis because of the unsustainability of these processes. And actually, Godley argued that this would be the case if there was no change in the fiscal policy stance or an important increase in the net exports. Godley repeated his projections in the next years, and actually the crisis of 2007 to 2009 verified these fears of Godley. Hyman Minsky developed a theory that explains why indebtedness increases in periods of stability and tranquility. And in order to explain this, he argued that during these periods, there is an endogenous decline in the desired margins of safety of economic units. And according to Minsky's theory, this gradual reduction in the desired margins of safety is the main reason behind the increased financial fragility. And his financial stability hypothesis states that the increasing fragility makes the macro system more prone to shocks, and in particular to shocks that affect the ability of borrowers to meet their debt payment commitments. Now, whenever we have these shocks, according to Minsky's theory, it's very possible to have important economic recessions. And many people have argued that the processes that are described in Minsky's theoretical framework are broadly in line with many developments that we had in the United States and other developed economies before the crisis. Now, generally speaking, the emphasis that both Godley and Minsky placed on debt and financial relationships as sources of serious instability allowed them to provide some useful insights into the dynamics of modern macroeconomics. And it is important to keep in our mind that they did so from quite different angles. In particular, Godley focused more on the relationships between the private, the government, and the foreign sector. And he tried to explain the fluctuations in financial balances and growth by using a kind of an exogenous stock flow norm that these sectors target in the medium run. On the other hand, we have Miski, who focuses more on the relationships between within the private sector. And in particular, he concentrated on the financial relationships between firms and banks. He tried to explain the macroeconomic fluctuations by focusing on the changes that take place in norms and in the perceptions of risks during the economic cycles. Especially after the crisis, it is widely held that Godley's and Minsky's perspectives can be very useful in our understanding of the macroeconomic dynamics. Despite this fact, there is still a lack of a framework that synthesizes these views. So in this paper, what I want to do is to make such a synthesis by using a simple macrodynamic model. And this model focuses on specific aspects of Godley's and Minsky's approaches, and in particular, I focus on these aspects that I regard more important in order to explain debt cycles and instability. There are two key features of this model. The first is that I follow Godley's projection analysis, and I have an economy with three sectors: the private sector, the government sector, and the foreign sector. And by doing so, I take explicitly into account the financial balance approach of Godley, which has been used in order to explain the change in debt and economic growth, using as a basis the interconnections between these three sectors. A second feature of the model is that the private expenditures are driven by a stock flow norm, and this is in line with Godley's perspective. But following Minsky, I assume that this stock flow norm changes endogenously during the economic cycle as a result of changes in the expectations and the norms of borrowers and lenders. Moreover, I also concentrate on the stabilizing role of fiscal policy. Both Godley and Minsky pinpointed the important role of fiscal policy in stabilizing unstable macroeconomic systems. And in this paper, I examine this role by considering two different fiscal rules. I first consider a Maastricht-type fiscal rule, which concentrates on the stabilization of the government debt. And then I consider a fiscal rule that I call a Godley-Minsky fiscal rule, which actually links the changes in government expenditures with the private indebtedness. This is the structure of the rest of my presentation. I will first present the main features of the model, and then I will describe the dynamic analysis in the model step by step. I will start with the two dimensions subsystem, which describes the interaction between net private indebtedness and private spending. Then I will introduce the target net private indebtedness, which is endogenous in the model according to the Minsky mechanism, and this is the 3D subsystem. In the fourth section, I will describe the role of fiscal policy, and then I will outline some conclusions. In the slide, you can see the transactions matrix of our economy. As I said before, we have the private sector, the government sector, and the foreign sector. In this transaction matrix, we have all the transactions that take place in the economy within a specific period. And every inflow is denoted by using a plus sign in front of the corresponding symbol, while we use a minus sign in front of symbols that correspond to outflows. For instance, if you take the taxes, we have that the taxes are an outflow for the private sector, so we use a minus sign, and because they are an inflow for the government sector, we use a plus sign. In the model, I have three types of equations. First of all, I have the accounting identities, which stem from the transactions matrix. Then I have some definitions for some variables that are quite important in the model. And finally, I have some behavioral equations. If we start with accounting identities, I have first the output of the economy, which is equal to the private expenditures plus government expenditures plus exports minus imports. The disposable income of the private sector is equal to the output of the economy minus taxes minus the interest payments. And then I have the equations that describe the change in the net debt in each of the three sectors of the economy. And we have that the change in net debt in each of these sectors is the opposite of the balance of the sector. So in the case of the net private debt, we have that the change in net private debt is equal to the private expenditures minus the income of the private sector. The change in net government debt is equal to the government expenditures plus the interest payments minus the taxes. And regarding the net foreign debt, we have that the change in net foreign debt is equal to the exports minus imports minus the interest payments. Now, by using the accounting identities, we actually get the financial balances approach of Godley, according to which the sum of the three balances of the three sectors of the economy is equal to zero. This identity has been widely used not only by Godley but also by various economists that have tried to explain some important macroeconomic developments in various advanced economies. And there are various implications of this identity. First of all, we have that in order to experience a decline in the balance of one sector, some balances of the other sectors have to change accordingly. Moreover, another implication is that since the financial balances have components that are also components of the aggregate demand, any attempt of the sectors to improve their balances may have an impact on the output of the economy if the other sectors do not desire to experience lower balances. There is a simplification behind this financial balance approach, and the simplification is that we consolidate the households, the firms, and banks into one single sector. Of course, this is a simplification that has various limitations. However, it has proved quite useful in Godley's projections and similar empirical analysis, and especially in these analyses that focus on the interaction between the behavior of the private sector, the fiscal policy, and the external balance. And actually, we adopt this approach in the model because we want to focus on the dynamics of a national macroeconomy by using a high-level aggregation. Now, I have some definitions. Here is the propensity of the private sector to spend, which is equal to the private expenditures divided by the income of the sector. I have the government expenditures to output ratio, and I also have the debt ratio of the private sector and the debt ratio of the government sector. Lastly, I have the behavioral equations. First of all, I have some simple equations that describe the taxes. The taxes are proportional to the output of the economy. The imports are also proportional to the output of the economy. And regarding exports, I have assumed that they grow at an exogenously given rate. And this rate is given in the model and can capture things like the structural competitiveness of the economy or the income of the foreign sector, which affects the exports of an economy. Now, I have the propensity of the private sector to spend. This is a formula that draws on Godley's perspective. The change in the private sector's propensity to spend is affected by the difference between the actual debt ratio and the targeted ratio. In particular, we have that whenever the actual debt ratio is higher than the target one, then there is a decline in the propensity of the private sector to spend. And the opposite happens when the private debt ratio is below the target. In his analysis, Godley demonstrated that in the long run, there is a stock flow norm for the private sector, and in his projections, the stock flow norm is given by the net financial assets of the private sector as a proportion of the disposable income. And he argued that the private sector in the long run tries to achieve this target. In my model, the stock flow norm is the target debt ratio. And it is important to point out that this target debt ratio is not only affected by the private sector, but also by the potential lenders of this sector. For example, this target may capture the willingness of foreign investors to lend to the private sector of a national economy, households, firms, or banks. And therefore, this target in the model reflects the decisions of both borrowers and lenders. Another question refers to the way that the target debt ratio changes. And here I use Minsky's perspective. I assume that the target debt ratio changes according to the economic growth. In particular, Minsky argued that during periods of expansion where we have stability and where the debts are serviced without significant problems, there is a reduction in the desired margins of safety of borrowers and lenders. And this is a case because there is a good performance in the economy and the economic units are more willing to accept financial structures that were previously considered as risky. And we have the opposite in periods in which economic growth is low. Despite the fact that Minsky's argument basically concentrated on the relationship between firms and banks, in this model I use this perspective for the relationship between the private sector and its lenders and borrowers, because I think that this argument can be used for any kind of borrower-lender relationship. So what the equation of this model implies is that whenever economic growth is higher than a benchmark growth rate, then the target debt ratio of the private sector increases. And the opposite when economic growth is below the benchmark growth rate. And by making the target debt ratio endogenous, actually our equation can be seen as an extension of Godley's exogenous stock flow norm. However, the economic growth is not the only factor that affects the target debt ratio in the model. I have assumed that there is a benchmark debt ratio which captures institutional factors in the economy, like the financial institutions or the political relationships of the country with other countries, and this actually attracts partially the target debt ratio. And we have two cases. We have the case in which the benchmark net debt ratio is positive, and then we have a net debtor private sector, while when this net debt ratio is negative, we have that the private sector is a net creditor. Now, the last behavioral equations refer to the fiscal rules. As I said before, I have a massive type fiscal rule which states that whenever the actual debt ratio of the government is higher than the target, then we have a decline in the government expenditures. And I have also another fiscal rule, the Godley-Minsky fiscal rule, as I call it, where actually the government expenditures take into account the stance of the private sector. So, whenever the private sector has a debt that is higher than the target one, and there are forces that lead to recession, then the government expenditures increase in order to counteract these forces. So there's a very different rationale behind this rule, and there are no limits regarding the fiscal aggregates compared to the Maastricht fiscal rule. Before I proceed to describe the dynamic analysis of the model, I think that there are two interesting things about the equations that describe the law of motion of the private debt ratio and the government debt ratio. These are the equations that reflect the law of motion in these two debt ratios. There are two points that are interesting. The first point is that if you do a very simple stability analysis, you take that in order to have stability in these ratios, you need the growth rate to be higher than the interest rate. First of all, this is important because it may show that monetary policy has a role to play in this stability. So the lower the interest rate, the more possible it is to have a stability in the debt ratios. Another interesting point is that if we consider the growth rate as endogenous, which is what we do in this model, then we have that any attempt of the private or the government sector to reduce their indebtedness may not always lead to the desired results. This is because first we have a spending effect, as I call it, where the decline in the expenditures actually tends to reduce the debt ratio. However, we have also a growth effect because the expenditures affect the growth rate in the economy, and since output is the denominator of the debt ratios, you may have an impact that actually outweighs the spending effect. So the overall result depends on whether the spending effect is outweighed or not by the growth effect. Now, this is the full 5D macroeconomic system. The endogenous variables in the model are the net private debt to income ratio, the propensity of the private sector to spend, the target net private debt to income ratio, the net government debt to output ratio, and finally we have the government expenditures, and their change is determined either by the Maastricht type fiscal rule or by the Gottlieb-Minsky fiscal rule. In the two-dimensional subsystem, I focus on the interaction between the net private indebtedness and the private spending. So I have used the first two equations of the macro system. And if when I do the mathematical analysis, what I find is that the stability of this system is affected by the propensity, by the way that the private sector responds to the divergence between the actual and the targeted ratio. The higher this responsiveness, and this is reflected in lambda, the more the system becomes unstable. And the reason that we have this instability is that actually when there is a high responsiveness, then the growth effect actually becomes important, and this can destabilize the system. And actually we can see that for a wide range of lambda values, we have unstable cycles in the economy. In the next slide, I have these unstable cycles. So, let me assume that we are in phase one, where we have high growth and declining indebtedness. We have high growth because in our simulations, the target debt ratio is 0.25. So, if we are in phase one, the actual debt ratio is below the target. Therefore, the private sector has a tendency to increase spending. This increase in spending produces high growth. At the same time, the propensity to spend is not so high. And therefore, we have that the growth effect dominates the spending effect, and therefore, indebtedness declines. As time passes, we have that the private sector's propensity to spend increases. And this increase in the propensity to spend, at some point in time, produces an increase in the indebtedness. So, in phase two, we are in a phase in which we have high growth, but at the same time, increasing fragility. When the economy enters in phase three, we have that the debt ratio of the private sector becomes higher than the target one, and as a result, the private sector attempts to reduce its indebtedness by decreasing the private expenditures. And in this case, we have low growth. So phase three can be seen as a period of stagnation, where at the same time we have rising indebtedness because the spending effect dominates the growth effect. After some time, because the private sector reduces its propensity to spend, the indebtedness starts declining. And this is important because the decline in the indebtedness is necessary in order to bring the economy back to phase one, where the debt ratio is below the target, and therefore the private sector starts again to increase the spending. And when we enter phase one, actually we have a new cycle. Now, the important thing about this diagram is that every cycle is wider than the previous one, and this leads to instability. And if we take this into account, what we have is that there is a kind of a paradox of debt, because the more the private sector tries to control its indebtedness, the more the system becomes unstable, and as a result, the indebtedness is not controlled. In the next slides, I describe these processes. Let me emphasize that the unstable cycles are also reflected in the three balances of the economy. And I have the three balances here, where you can see that every change in one balance actually is reflected in the other balances. In this 2D subsystem, the government expenditures are constant relative to the output, so we do not have a significant change in the government balance. So every change in the private balance is mirrored in the foreign balance. And you can see that as time passes, the cycles become higher. Now, one other thing that it is interesting about this is that there are some periods in which it seems that the foreign balance actually goes quite well, but because of the instability, these periods are actually followed by periods where we have the opposite. So this instability says that we do not have a specific equilibrium in the economy. We have cycles, and we have changes in the way that the balances perform. Now let me turn to the 3D subsystem, where I have endogenized the target net private indebtedness, and therefore we have used the three first equations in the whole macro system. In this analysis, I start from a stable 2D subsystem because I want to see whether the introduction of an endogenous target debt ratio can increase the instability in the economy. Here, the significant parameter is parameter theta and theta 1. Theta 1 captures the responsiveness of the target debt ratio to the economic cycle. The higher theta 1, the more the private sector and its lenders respond to changes in economic growth. It can be shown that a higher theta 1 is conducive to instability. And I will first show this in the diagrams that I have some simulations, where you can see that we have the time and we have theta 1. As theta 1 increases, actually we have that the fluctuations in the net private debt to income ratio become higher. So the more the private sector responds by changing the target debt ratio to the economic cycle, the higher the fluctuations in the private debt to income ratio. And this is also the case, of course, for the target debt ratio and for the growth rate of the economy. We see similar fluctuations that increase as time passes. And it is interesting that despite the fact that in the 3D subsystem, the government expenditures do not change, because of the change in economic growth, we have that the government debt-to-output ratio also changes. Now, let me very briefly explain why this happens. First, let me consider the periods of low growth. When we have in a period of low growth, actually in the model, this implies that the private indebtedness is high relative to the target indebtedness. So the private sector tries to reduce the spending. And when we have that the target debt ratio is endogenous, low growth makes the target debt ratio actually to become even lower. So the difference between the actual and the target debt ratio becomes higher, and the impact on growth is more important. So if we compare this with the 2D subsystem, we have that actually in periods of low growth, we have lower growth relative to the previous case. On the other hand, in periods of high growth, where the target debt ratio is higher than the actual one, we have that because of economic growth, the target debt ratio becomes even higher, and the difference between these two ratios becomes more important, and thereby high economic growth becomes even higher. So the amplitude of the cycles actually increases as a result of the endogenous target debt ratio. And let me now explain what is the difference if we introduce fiscal rules. Let me consider first the Maastricht-type fiscal rule. As I said before, this rule says that whenever the actual government debt ratio is higher than the target, then the government expenditures should decline. And let me focus first on the case in which we have that the economy has low economic growth, and in the model this implies that the net private indebtedness is high. And because of low economic growth, the debt ratio of the government is actually adversely affected, because we have a tendency for the denominator to become actually lower, and therefore the government debt ratio increases. Because of this fact, at some point in time in the period of low growth, the government debt ratio becomes higher than the target one, and the government responds by decreasing the government expenditures. By doing so, actually the period of low growth becomes worse, and we have that there is a higher decline in economic activity because of this stance of the fiscal authorities. And this is important not only because of the direct effects of spending, of the government spending on economic growth, but because by doing so, the government affects the expectations of borrowers and lenders. And therefore, we have a change in the target debt ratio of the private sector that reinforces the contractionary effects. In the case that we have economic growth that is high, we have the inverse mechanism. So, actually, the massive-type fiscal rule increases the amplitude of the economic cycles. And you can see this in the next diagrams. If we compare these diagrams with the previous ones that refer to the 3D subsystem, the amplitude of the cycles is higher both for low theta 1 and much more higher for theta 1 that is high. And we can see this in the net private debt to income ratio, of course in the target net private debt to income ratio, and in the growth rate of the economy. You can see that after some period, growth rate has very significant fluctuations. Now, it is interesting that despite the fact that the fiscal policy rule tries to target a specific debt ratio, actually this fiscal rule makes the net government debt to output ratio to fluctuate more. So, despite the fact that the fiscal authorities try to control the debt ratio, they actually fail to do so in this model. And this is also the case for the balance, for the government balance to output ratio. On the other hand, yes, and I would like to emphasize here that a kind of a paradox of debt also applies in the public sector. Because the more the public sector tries to control the government indebtedness, the more this debt ratio destabilizes. If we go now to the Godley-Minsky fiscal rule, we have that this rule seems to stabilize not only the private economy, but also the fiscal aggregates. And why is this a case? This is a case because of the counter-cyclical rationale behind this rule. So whenever the private sector tries to reduce its indebtedness by producing a decline in the propensity of the private sector to spend, then we have that the government sector increases the expenditures, and therefore we do not have a significant decline in economic growth. And the opposite holds in periods where the private sector tends to increase its expenditures. And by doing so, by stabilizing the economy and economic growth, we have also stability in the fiscal aggregates. So in the next slide, we can see this. The higher theta 1, the more stable the net private debt to income ratio. The same is the case for the target, of course, and for the growth rate. And regarding the net government debt to output ratio, you can see that although there are some fluctuations in the first periods, the fact that this rule stabilizes economic growth helps the debt to output ratio also to stabilize. And the same is the case for the balance of the government. So let me finish with some brief conclusions. In this model, I have tried to combine some certain aspects of Godley's and Minsky's frameworks. I produced some unstable debt in economic cycles, and these cycles were the result of the endogenous change in the propensity to spend of the private sector, as a result of differences between the actual and the target private indebtedness. An important result is that the Minsky mechanism that I put forward, according to which the target debt ratio changes during the economic cycles, actually destabilizes the macro system. Regarding the role of fiscal policy, the Maastricht-type fiscal rule seems to be destabilizing. As I said before, we have a kind of a paradox of debt for the government sector. And in the case of the Kodály-Minsky fiscal rule, we actually have that not only the private sector stabilizes, but also the fiscal aggregates stabilize after some periods. And overall, this paper tries to emphasize the importance of Godless and Minsky's views about the instability of the macroeconomy and, of course, about the stabilizing role of fiscal policy. And probably a useful line for future research would be to combine the Godless-Minsky cycles produced in this paper that focus more on the role of debt with the traditional Goodwin cycles that concentrate on the role of income distribution. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yanis. Marco?
So should please? I go close to the microphone?
I can bring that, actually.
Oh, okay. First of all, let me say that I'm very happy, very glad to be here. It's an honor. And it's an honor to have this chance to discuss this paper, which is a very interesting paper. As the author, Yanis, develops a macro dynamic model, cross-breeding the Godless financial balances approach, or stock flow consistent approach, with the financial instability hypothesis of Ayman Minsky. The text of the paper is very clear, and the mathematics of the model is very elegant and well developed. So I really appreciated that work. In my opinion, the author is successful in providing a theoretical synthesis between Godless and Minsky's work. As I will argue, one of the main strengths of this model is that it allows bypassing one of the most important issue with Minsky's theory, which is the controversial relationship between debt, investment and profit in Minsky's theory. As you probably know, there is a sort of missing link in the traditional reading of Minsky's work, at least. And this work allows us to overcome or to bypass this problem. Obviously, some improvements will be necessary, in my opinion, in the future, especially in order to drop or to relax some assumptions and hypotheses of the model. However, I think that the line of research chosen by the author is very, potentially very, very fruitful. This said, let me start with a literature review, because as I told to the author, you are right, there is a lack of literature trying to, this is quite odd actually, but there is a lack of literature trying to put together Minsky's and Godless works. But in my small way, I tried to provide a contribution in the Gibo. And the reason why I'm telling this to you is not because I think that my paper is fundamental, because it's not, except for the part in which I refer to Lavoie's work, which in a way could provide you an idea of how was the work of Lavoie before the stock flow consistent era, so that could be interesting to you. But because in that journal they published also another article you mentioned on Minsky's approach, which is the article of Rio, so that could be a destination for your work. So you have to think over this point. Turning to the model and to the paper, as I said, the way in which you crossbreed Godless framework and Minsky's insights is very smart. I have to say that, if I'm not wrong, Godless framework is used also by some journalists of the Financial Times, as Martin Wolf, to understand what happens in the real world. So outside the academia, it's quite popular among practitioners. In short, in your model, it is assumed in the wake of Godley that the private sector targets the long-run value of the net debt to income ratio. And private sector's propensity to spend is assumed to be a negative function of the gap between current debt ratio and the targeted debt ratio. So the higher is the current debt ratio compared to the targeted debt ratio, lower is the private expenditure in your model. Mm-hmm. And obviously vice versa. However, in the wake of Minsky theory, Godley's framework is extended in order to endogenize the debt to income ratio, as the net debt to income ratio of the private sector is assumed to be a positive function of the economic growth. In a way, it moves procyclically, and that's a good assumption. It's a proper Minskian assumption. This is shown to lead to higher financial instability compared to the hypothesis of fixed debt-to-income ratio. Notice that the reason why this model doesn't raise the same criticisms of the Minsky's model is that the change in the net debt-to-income ratio of the private sector is offset by the change in debt ratios of other sectors. So, in a way, the secret is disaggregate the economy in different subsectors, whereas in Minsky's framework you have just the private sector, so you can have a problem of the fallacy of composition. So your way of doing that, in my opinion, is very smart. It's a proper way to treat this point. And finally, you introduced also two different fiscal rules, the Maastricht type fiscal rules, which is a foolish fiscal rule against a proper counter-cyclical fiscal rule, which is the common sense fiscal rule. As I said, I think that the only weaknesses of the model are obviously the hypothesis of the model. The model, I double-checked also the mathematics, the model is perfect. But there are some very strong assumptions underpinning the model. One of the strongest one is that, if I'm not wrong, there are no changes in the financial asset prices. And this is a very, in a way, counter-Minskian hypothesis, as the whole Minskian financial instability hypothesis relies on the interaction between the demand price of capital assets and the supply price of new capital goods. So in a way you end up ruling out the Minsky's mechanism from your model. I wonder if this is a Godley's assumption in his models, because I don't remember this point. Second, I'm not, obviously you can imagine this, I'm not happy with the consolidation of households, firms and banks into one single private sector. I understand that your aim is to focus just on the dynamic interaction between the different macro sectors, but I think that the separation of the banking sector and the non-banking sector is not just an instrumental hypothesis that we can drop whenever we want. I think this is a sort of fundamental distinction that we should always introduce in good non-mainstream models. As for the separation between firms and households, again, my Marxist background leads me to think that perhaps we can neglect it when we deal with empirical works. But when we do theoretical models, we should try to consider this distinction. Otherwise, we end up to constructing models which are none other than mainstream models without micro foundations and dynamic optimization of utility functions, which is good, but in my opinion is not enough to provide a real alternative to mainstream models. In this regard, I wonder whether it would be possible to build a complementary model with banks, firms and households replacing foreign sector, private sector and government sector. Maybe you can think something about that. In my opinion, it could be possible to build this very similar model with different sector and then to integrate or crossbreed the two models. As for the results, one of the most important, though hidden results of your model is to show that positions of surplus sectors and deficit sectors are not symmetrical. When you are a net debtor, the decline in the rate of growth due to the attempt to reduce debt by reducing expenditure may offset the effect of expenditure cuts. By contrast, when you are a net creditor, the reduction in the rate of growth magnifies your relative surplus. I wonder if in the future this could be used in order to analyze imbalances in the euro area, because it seems to me that this is a very good point against austerity measures in the euro area. So this could be another future development of your model. Before I conclude my discussion, I would like to ask a number of questions. The first, it is not clear to me what the role of external imbalances is, because you clarify that in a three-sector economy, an economy in which we have government, private and foreign sector, the balance of one sector cannot improve without deterioration in at least one of the other two sectors. Consequently, given the private sector balance, a government deficit necessarily leads to a foreign sector surplus. And that means that given the private sector balance, a government deficit leads to a deficit in the trade balance and in your model in the current account balance of the balance of payments, of course. So what is the effect of such imbalance, of such deficit in your model? I raise this question because as you argued, any change in the financial balance of the private sector is almost entirely mirrored in the foreign sector. You've shown us also the pictures from which we can see that the effect is mirrored almost entirely in the foreign balance sector. So do you attribute to the foreign sector just a passive role, or is it assumed to have also an active role? Second, it is not clear to me what is the role of the interest rate. If I'm not wrong, interest rate in your model is fixed. Third, when a godly Minsky fiscal rule is adopted, and obviously I agree with you that that's the rule, not the Maastricht type fiscal rule, the level of the debt to income ratio of government sector has no feedback on the rest of the system. you clarify this point in a footnote, if I'm not wrong. So when you have that rule, you have a four equation system. In principles, this is right. However, you are assuming that the country considered has a full monetary sovereignty. But in the real world, if you have, this is not always the case. So you could have an effect on interest rates, and I wonder if you could relax this hypothesis in your future work. Last point, sometimes in your paper you talk about expectations of borrowers and lenders. However, you don't explicitly model expectations in your model. So do you mean that those expectations are mirrored in some parameters or exogenous or endogenous variables in your model? So that's all for the moment.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. And I think that they are very constructive. Yes, I have made various simplifying assumptions, because my main point was to use a simple framework in order to capture some simple dynamics. And in my view, if someone wants to introduce more realistic assumptions in the model, I think that I have done this in continuous time, and I have already a 5D system in some cases. So if I want to introduce some of the very interesting things that you have mentioned, maybe a stock flow consistent model with discrete time would be more appropriate for doing this. So I have avoided to do this in the current paper, but I agree with you that some extensions of this paper could be to introduce some of the channels that you described. And actually, this is easier to do in the discrete time framework. Okay. Where the problem is that when you increase the number of the endogenous variables in the model, actually it's not very easy to understand what is happening in the economy. So the reason that I tried to not using so many realistic things in the model is first to understand some main dynamics, and you know, if I have understood them, maybe the next step would be easier if I introduce some more realistic assumptions in the model. Now, more specifically about the financial asset prices. Yes, I agree, there's an assumption that there is no change in the asset prices, and you know that this is also a problem in the empirical analysis in many cases, especially if you consider the asset side of the sectors, because you may have a change in the asset side of the sector basically because the prices change, not because a change in the balance. And this introduces many complexities when you do empirical analysis, and someone has to be very careful with these issues, because maybe the balance does not affect in a simple way the net debt and the net financial assets. To some extent, this Mishkin perspective, in a very simple way, is captured in this model by assuming implicitly that whenever there is an increase in the targeted ratio, because borrowers and lenders become more willing to participate in new debt contracts, a reason for this may be also the rise in asset prices, which increases the willingness of borrowers and lenders to do so. But this is very implicit in the model, and of course I have not analyzed this in any explicit way. Regarding the consolidation, yes, this is one of the main limitations of the model, and actually in the paper I have briefly mentioned that there's a discussion about this, and of course many people do not like so much this perspective of Kotley that has consolidated households, firms and banks into one single sector. Now, again, I wanted to have a general picture of the national macroeconomy, and that's why I adopted this assumption. There was a discussion about this, and actually many people, when Godley started doing his projections, were not happy with this hypothesis. And but I think that gradually many people understand that if you want to analyze without doing going into the details, if you want to analyze some aggregate macro developments in an economy, this distinction between three sectors is useful, at least at the first stage. Mm. So I think that you can start from this, and you know that there are many economists that have used this approach in order to analyze not only the United States the situation, but also in European countries, and you can get some insights into the basic macro developments. So I think that this is a first step, and of course I agree with you that then you have to go into the details, and whether the household sector, the firm sector, or the banking sector drive the debt cycles or not, and what is the relationship between these sectors. So yes, I agree that in future there could be an extension of this model towards this direction, and this is why at the end of the paper I mentioned that these debt cycles in the model can be combined with the Goodwin cycles that concentrate on the relationship between firms and the workers. And I have actually this in my mind, how these kind of cycles can be reconciled with other cycles that refer to the relationships within the private sector. Regarding the net debt, the net debtor and the net creditor position of the private sector, yes, I think that, and I have in my mind that behind this model there are many empirical issues, because you can see that many countries have for many years a net debtor position and others a net creditor position, and I think that this is also related with various institutions and the relationships between the countries. And if someone analyzes, for instance, the case of the United States, he or she can see that for the period after the Second World War, the private sector was in a net creditor position, but after the 20s, we had a change. Excuse me, after the 80s, we had a change. And then we have a private sector that is actually a net debtor. So it is interesting to see this because first, you may have some long-run changes in this situation. So it is not only cross-country, it's also a time series phenomenon. So you may have changes in this position. And it is also interesting that you may have here also some Minskian effects. And I think also that the perspective of Minsky about the long waves and the distinction with the short cycles can give some insights into this aspect. I haven't mentioned this, of course, in the paper, but I think that in Minsky's theory, you have that the increased financial fragility is a kind, in some of his analysis, is a kind of a long wave, where you have for many years an increase in financial fragility, which is gradual. And maybe the change that we had in the United States captures some of these developments, which are also associated with the financial institutions and the way that we have financial innovation and so on. So yes, I think that there are many important and interesting empirical issues regarding this aspect. In the model, I have that actually the external sector is quite passive, and this stems from the fact that I have assumed that the growth rate of the exports is exogenous. It is very easy to make this endogenous, actually, because you can assume that this growth rate is affected by various factors, and you can. It is interesting to see that the higher the growth rate of exports, the easier it is for the debt ratios of the private and the government sector to stabilize, because this affects positively the growth rate of the economy. So I did so because I wanted to focus on the relationship between the government and the private sector, but it's very easy to change this assumption. In the two-dimensional system that you mentioned, actually, in this system, there are no changes in the government expenditures. That's why you saw that the government balance doesn't change. I don't have explicitly in the paper the results about the balances in the 3D or the 5D subsystem, where you can see that also the government balance changes. But again, it remains that the external sector is quite passive in the model, and I have done so in order to focus on the other two sectors and possibly in an extension to analyze how the relationship between these two sectors and the relationship between the domestic economy and the external economy changes when the exports increase or decrease according to some other factors. Regarding the role of monetary policy, yes, this paper focuses more on fiscal policy. As I said, monetary policy is important because it affects the interest rate of the economy, and this can affect the stability of the debt ratios. But I could also have considered the monetary policy probably in the counter-cyclical way, because someone could argue that whenever you have that the fiscal policy tries to reduce the propensity of the private sector to actually increase the amplitude of the cycles, one way could be to combine the reduction, for instance, in the government expenditures with a higher interest rate, and the opposite, if you want to have the opposite results in the economy. So there could be a kind of coordination between fiscal policy and monetary policy, but I think that monetary policy is not so effective as fiscal policy in changing the propensity of the private sector to spend more in periods of expansion and spend less in periods where the economic performance is not so good. But this could be the case in the model. You could have also a counter-cyclical monetary policy in order to combine this with the fiscal policy. The other issue that you mentioned, and I agree with this, is that you may have that in the real world, the government debt ratio affects the interest rates. And when I have the golden Minsky fiscal rule, actually I take a case in which the government debt doesn't matter, although we stabilize this after some periods, but I take the case where this doesn't have feedback effects on the economy. One way to introduce an effect, yes, would be to say that in an economy where the government debt matters, because there is no central bank that is independent relative to the investors abroad, yes, in this case you have that the interest rate may be affected. And actually this would destabilize probably the debt ratios if you have this effect. But this is again a policy issue, so it's a kind of a choice if you want to have a connection with this interest rate. So this is a broad issue, and I decided not to introduce this in the model. And regarding the expectations, actually the assumption that I have done is that the growth rate of the economy is what drives the expectations. So we have the growth rate that changes the expectations, and theta 1, this parameter in this equation, shows the impact of the growth rate on the targeted ratio. So if we have assumed that the growth rate captures the expectations, and we have through theta 1 the impact on the target debt ratio. And let me very briefly make a comment on this fact about the paradox of debt and Minsky and so on. What I did in order to avoid the problem of the paradox of debt in Minsky's analysis is that I didn't assume that whenever the economic growth rate is high, that the actual debt ratio becomes higher. I assumed that the debt ratio is the result of the macroeconomic relationships, but what changes is the target debt ratio. So I make this distinction, where this distinction also refers to the distinction between the actual margins of safety and the desired ones. Because in my view, in Minsky, what the argument is that the target ratios or the desired ratios change, not the actual ones necessarily. This is the result of the macroeconomic relationship. So this is how I tried to avoid this problem.
Yeah, this is a good point. I agree with you. May I just ask you very brief comment. Why did you use continuous time in your model? Why did you choose to use continuous? This is a methodological question. And second, it's true that Godley used to employ consolidated models, but did he use also? Did he consolidate also banks with the other sectors, because if I'm not wrong, he consolidated the private sector, I mean firms and houses, not the banking sector.
Actually, in his stock flow consistent models, the theoretical models that have been solved by using simulations, there he has households, firms and banks. In his projection analysis, he has basically used this consolidation for the private sector. And I think that he did so because he believed that he can have the overall picture of the economy by doing so. And actually, it is easier in empirical analysis to do this, because sometimes in the data, you have problems when you have some variables that are of firms, of households and banks. Because in the data, sometimes it's not very easy to make a very detailed distinction between these sectors regarding some specific variables. And I think that this has also to do with some empirical issues. But what I did is that I have found that the private sector has been consolidated in empirical analysis, and there is no theoretical model that tries to take this into account. And I think that, again, this can give an overall picture that can be important in our thinking about the economies at the general level. Now, regarding the continuous and discrete time, there is a lot of debate about this issue, and there are some post-Keynesian people that prefer to use continuous time and some others that prefer to use discrete time. I think that there are advantages and disadvantages. Basically, the discrete time has been connected with the stock flow consistent models, like the ones of Godley and Lavoisier. I have worked a lot on these models, and you know that a critique about these models is that you have many questions. You cannot easily decide if you are going to use lag for this variable or for another variable. So there is a kind, you have to make a selection that maybe cannot be, cannot be something that you are sure about this. But this is one drawback. The other drawback, which is maybe more important, is that you cannot analyze all the cases about the solution of the model, because you have many, many questions. And by using continuous time, you can use some mathematical theorems that actually can guide you, and you can, by using the theorems, understand the basic mechanisms in the model, and if you have stability, cycles, or instability. So, since I wanted to do a small model, I think that for models, continuous time is good, because you can use these mathematical approaches, and you can understand better the dynamics. And actually, by solving the model, I understood some things that were not very obvious when I started creating the model. For instance, this distinction between net creditor and net debtor position was the result of the mathematical analysis. So, in my view, it depends on the purpose. Both of them, for me, are fine.
Thank you. My name is Graham Gutchett. I'm in the Centre for Business Research in the Business School in Cambridge, but that's of more relevance to the seminar. As a member of Wynne Godley's Cambridge Economic Policy Group in the 1980s in Cambridge. I'd like to congratulate Yanis. I thought it was an exceptionally clear description of what Godley's all about, and to some extent Minsky. And also for doing a very, I think, important and exceptionally interesting synthesis of the two approaches. It's an interesting extension. But I wanted, in questions, take up two points that Marco made. Mm-hmm. Firstly, about capital gains, but both in the direction of reality, really. Mm-hmm. One about capital gains, and the other about the composition of the model and the decomposition of the private sector into particularly general sorts, firms and banks. And in doing that, just put in a reminder, really, that I think Wynne Godley's work gained a great deal from combining empirical work with theoretical work. His monetary economics with Marc Lavoisier is wholly theoretical in that sense. But at the same time, he was doing empirical work, and all his life he did macroeconomic modelling in an empirical way. I'd like to say a little more about that in a moment. Firstly, on the decomposition of the sectors, I don't know if you can see this. Can you see this chart? Yeah, can you see that, Michael? The bottom line here is the private sector debt to GDP ratio.
In the UK?
UK. Mm-hmm. And the top one is the household sector. So the first and most obvious thing is the private sector ratio that you use, 0.25, and it's occasionally there, but it's fairly close to balance and zero.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the household sector ratio is almost 10 times larger. And of course, this reflects a number of things. And a lot of the interesting action, say in the UK and the US economies over the last two or three decades, has been an increase in household indebtedness, an increase in bank lending, particularly to households. And that's an intra private sector flow that gets netted out when you look at the private sector as a whole. So in looking at the private sector, you're netting out a lot of the most interesting things that have happened. And again, if I come back to this point about doing empirical work at the same time, you start doing modelling and want to take part in policy debates, it's very hard to do so unless you actually do this disaggregation. Even here, this is the net debt or net asset ratio of households. Even there is covering up or disguising what's happened, because there's been an increase in indebtedness over this period, and also balanced by an increase in the asset ratio. That's something, by the way, that starts to be relevant to Piketty's work in increasing wealth ratio. The increasing debt ratio, we can see, hasn't mainly affected the net financial asset ratio, but it has affected house prices and therefore the value of housing wealth. If we take the total wealth of the private sector, then about half of it is housing and half of it is financial assets. A lot of the financial assets are in fact equities, and that's what's going on with these big cycles here. So in the 1970s we had the huge 60-70% fall in company stock prices after the 1974 oil price increase. And then we have the recovery after 1980 up to the peak of the millennium boom and then the collapse of the millennium boom. So the net financial asset ratio of the household sector has gone from about 1 to 2.5. And there was a long stability over 60 years, but there's a great deal of instability over that period. But a lot of that instability wasn't very much reflected in spending, partly because a lot of this takes place, as far as households are concerned, takes place in pension fund values, which most households aren't very aware of that they at the time. Mm-hmm. So I think if one wants to tell an empirical story,
yeah,
and really take part in policy debates, it seems to me it's much better to do it. Now, Marco asked you about the theoretical decomposition here, and I think that does make for difficulties. I've done this in macroeconomic empirical modelling, and you can do it fine, so no great problem. But if you were to extend your model to a household company and banking sector, that's of course causes of what I do in the book, it would be very interesting. And just as the last point, I'm perhaps saying this to Marco rather than yourself, I thought one of the great strengths of Codre Lavoir as a book was the amount of detail on the banking sector and the integration of how the banking sector works into a Keynesian system.
Mm-hmm.
This really gives you a good feel for how the whole economy works, including inside banks, which is what we're all missing. and why so many all forecasters, perhaps Wynne being one of the few exceptions, missed the crisis. People, even the Bank of England, wasn't modelling what was actually happening in South Africa. It was incredible, really. But we weren't.
Yeah. Actually, of course, I agree. If you want to have good empirical analysis, of course, you have to take into account households, firms, and banks. And potentially, banks have to be decomposed into more financial institutions. And you know that many people say that maybe the Godwin Lavoie book is good in terms of banking, but the current banking is not so close to the book of Godwin Lavoie, because we have so many financial innovations and so on. And yes, maybe also this is a limitation of the current stock flow of the models. And actually, in the Levy Institute, when they start to do this analysis, they start from the private sector without using different structures for government, for the firms, the banks, and the households. But gradually, they have changed this. But at the first stage, and also in the case of the Greek model, they started from the private sector. And maybe when you start developing an empirical model, this is maybe the first stage. You cannot stay there, that's for sure. And it's wrong, because especially over the last decades, we had many, many changes within the private sector that should be taken into account. I think that the consolidation of the private sector basically shows the relationships of the private sector with the other countries. And in my view, it can capture changes in the capital inflows and capital outflows in countries. So actually, when you have that the private indebtedness increases as a whole, what you actually have in most cases is that there's a kind of an investment for foreign investors in this country. They buy a lot of assets of this country, and this actually produces an increase in the indebtedness of the private sector. So it captures different mechanisms than maybe what we have in our mind when we speak about fragility and so on.
Yeah, I think that last point may be true of Greece and small countries, but
yes,
hasn't been true of the UK, and I shouldn't think the US either. It's really the banks creating credit.
Exactly. So in my view, it may be good only for these specific countries, but in order to capture the developments in the advanced economies, yes, it's for sure that you have to see within the private sector.
One can perhaps add, I accept that point, and one can perhaps add to that point that if you're interested in public debt, government debt, then it's really what happens to the private sector as a whole. You can see on here for the UK, not very much happens to household net debt, but private sector debt as a whole rises. And of course, that private sector net assets, let's call it that, becomes positive. And that's the offset for the great increase in public sector indebtedness. So if you concentrate on public sector indebtedness, which over Wynne got his career, he was in a sense, and he came out of the Treasury into academia and was very concerned with that. And you made the point about understanding what's happening in the euro area. Again, public sector indebtedness is a very big issue. I think if you're focusing on that, then and this is to strengthen your point, really. If you're focusing on public sector debt, then there is some advantage in just having a three-sector model, because that's where the offsets have to be. And to some extent in the balance of payments, but actually in a country like the UK or the US, it's going to be public-private offsets.
Yeah, actually, in this paper, I would like to develop a theoretical argument, basically, and I totally agree that if you go to the empirical issues and you want to analyze economies like the UK, you have to go into the details, which sometimes are not so straightforward, especially the issues with the capital gains and how these are reflected in financial assets, in the price of financial assets, and so on. I think that there is also a general problem sometimes with the macro models, and this relates with this fact, because we speak about the having households, firms, and banks. And for instance, people that try to model Minsky's framework use an aggregate firm sector and an aggregate household sector, but sometimes the fragility is within this sector. And because you may have that the sector is not in a positive position as a whole, but there may be that within this sector many units in a positive position. And if we have a problem with the repayment of debt of these units, then we have a change in the expectations. Maybe even the speculative or hedge units may have problems because of this. So, and this is a problem in macro models if you use an aggregate sector. And it's not an easy issue. It's related with this because we need always to disaggregate more and more in order to be sure that we capture all the developments within the economy. And I don't know, maybe this is a challenge for macroeconomics to try to find a way to capture this fact.
Yes, I mean, those points are fair enough. But I think if one looks at economics as a discipline as a whole, people who do theoretical modelling, perhaps most of professional economists, develop skills in that area and don't develop skills in, they don't understand the data.
Don't
develop the skills. So they, in a sense, they dig themselves deeper and deeper into the theory. And as we've seen in the discipline as a whole, it's veered away from a lot of practical policy application. So the lesson of Wynne Godley's career was just keep a foot in both camps and you'll have interesting things to say about policy.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for a fascinating talk.
Thank you.
And a fascinating discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.